From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, please let me say a very sincere thank you to you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. It may be popular among the political religious right to claim not to believe in climate change, but the climate really doesn't care. As another almost unprecedented natural disaster, the massive Hurricane Michael brought devastation and misery to a wide swath of the country, scientists explain how events like this are being intensified by changing temperatures and trends. Our thoughts this weekend are with all of those in the American Southeast who are dealing with the aftermath of this disaster. As we wait for the growing environmental evidence to finally break through the denial that so many of our lawmakers continue to cling to. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
All of the arguments to deny people their civil rights were based in religious roots. And the same thing happens today against gay people. I don't want one more kid to go through what I went through. That's how bad it was.
Is it the inevitable march of human progress? Is it the arc of the moral universe bending toward justice? Or are we on the doorstep of a backlash that will profoundly harm LGBTQ Americans in the name of politics, religion, or both? With a lifetime of activism around these issues, Mitchell Gold has a perspective that few others have. And on this week's show, Mitchell will be back with us as a part of our special series, Whosoever You Love.
In my work, I've seen everything. But what I saw last night scared me so much. All I could do was lay there paralyzed.
You're thinking of retiring?
I just feel like God is telling me to do something different.
The Commander and Chief Prophecy?
There'll be healing, great healing. There'll be healing in the land.
One of the defining features of our age is the way our nation is dividing along political lines, with each side unable and unwilling to understand the other. But what happens when one side then claims divine will as justification for their beliefs? It's been happening a lot on the political religious right, and a new film called The Trump Prophecy drives the message home on this week's show. We'll get details from Vox.com religion writer Tara Burton. But first,
several Des Moines organizations say they are the target of hate flyers. On Monday, groups like the Interfaith Alliance and Planned Parenthood said flyers came from a nationally recognized hate organization and that they contained anti-Semitic conspiracy propaganda.
Targeting a particular group of people for their faith and for their beliefs and perpetuating hate through propaganda, that is never okay.
As compelling as the ticket torch chants were at the deadly Charlottesville Unite the Right rally last year, the heavily armed men menacing the Jewish community inside the local synagogue that weekend was, in retrospect, even more urgent, a warning of what was to come. Anti-Semitic events are surging across the nation, and this week, ugly propaganda was literally plastered on an Interfaith Alliance affiliate in America's heartland. For a look at the impact and strategies to rise above that kind of hate, I'm very pleased to welcome Interfaith Alliance of Iowa Executive Director Connie Ryan back to our show. Connie, thank you for being with us again.
Well, thank you, Welton, for having me. It is always a pleasure.
Would you briefly describe what happened?
Certainly. On Monday morning of this week, I arrived at my office, and we have an external door that just faces the street. And as I came up to the office, I realized there was paper on our door, and it was an anti-Semitic hate flyer that was being distributed, but later learned around the country and in Des Moines, a couple of different places. And when I saw it, I've said to several people, it just took my breath away.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I haven't seen hate before, not that I haven't experienced, you know, that in the work that we do, we have that happen. But each time it happens, it just startles you and stuns you, because we do such good work to stop hate and to have it literally taped to my door, the visual of that, it just took my breath away.
Why now? What's happening now that really hasn't happened before?
It's hard to know why us in particular. Why now? Certainly the rise in rhetoric, both from political leaders and then also nationalistic white supremacist groups, that is certainly on the rise. You know, I was talking with your colleague, Rabbi Jack Moline, earlier in the week, and mm-hmm. his wise words to me were, you can't make logic out of hate. Mm-hmm. And that is so true. You know, why they chose us, I don't know. They also targeted Planned Parenthood in the Des Moines area and mm-hmm. a couple of their clinics. You know, I try not to get into their heads mm-hmm. and figure that out. What I do know is the resulting impact and the resolve that it really brings to me and to many people of how important this work is.
Well, you're very much aware there have been anti-Semitic acts across the country in the past couple of weeks. Do you see this as a coordinated pattern?
I would guess so, just simply because there have been so many actions. Although we don't put the images of the flyer or the verbiage of the flyer out, it's really our policy not to do that and to perpetuate their hate.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't use the name of the organization because we don't want to give them any more publicity. It is out there on the Internet. I've seen it numerous places.
Mm-hmm.
And so the same flyers that were taped to our door and the other locations in Des Moines were also taped to, you know, walls and doors of locations in other parts of the country, as far away as I saw as California. And so there has to be some kind of concerted effort to make that happen.
Sure. Well, there's an ongoing debate about how to deal with this kind of hateful provocation. Some argue that making it public gives oxygen to hate groups that are behind it. Others say it's critically important to confront and expose actions like this. Why did you feel going public was the right course of action?
I think it's always the right thing to go public with naming hate and what has happened, describing it in your own words, and the impact of that on you and other people. And to be sure, you know, we were the target of this flyer. We were not the subject matter. You know, I'm not Jewish. I don't pretend to understand the feelings that people who are regularly targeted with hate, you know, what they feel. So I do believe that it is important to talk about the actions that happened and the impact of that, and then also name what we can do in response. I don't believe that giving hate groups credibility or publicity by putting their images or their verbiage or even the name of the organization out for folks to see. I don't believe in that, just simply because I think that gives them too much power.
What do you think, Connie, people who have not found themselves on the receiving end of hate speech like this, whether on the Internet or in real life, what are they likely to not understand about the impact it has on the targets?
You know, I have a lot of privilege in my life. I am raised Christian, white, middle class, educated. So I have lots of characteristics that bring privilege to me, and I understand that. I have other parts of my life that are not privileged. Mm-hmm. And until it happens to you, until you receive that on your door, or you receive the words thrown at your face, or even more horrific actions of violence, I don't know if you can truly understand the emotional impact that it has. Certainly for me, as I looked at that flyer, it had emotional impact for me because I do this work to fight hate each and every day. So it certainly had an emotional impact on me, but it is not equivalent to people who receive the actual words of hate that are about them, or the actions or the violence directed at them. And so I think that we can have empathy, but I think most importantly, we have to listen to those who are directly impacted, hear their stories, and always be willing to stand alongside them.
Mm. Connie, there's been so much finger-pointing on the political right in recent weeks, describing the victim groups and activists who oppose the Kavanaugh nomination and the frenzy to confirm as rabid mobs, paid anarchists and worse. It blames the left for the shocking decline of civility in our public rhetoric. That kind of rhetoric is not only a lie, but it completely ignores the reality of the kinds of hate speech that you've just endured, the frequency of which has soared in the past 2 years. Do you have thoughts on how to correct the record?
What I think that people need to think about is there is probably responsibility on both sides. But what I don't hear from people who are progressive are those statements of hate toward groups of people. And so I do think that it is important that we name and call out when there are statements of hate or misinformation that is perpetuated about groups of people and the rhetoric that we're hearing in the public square. I think that is all not only fair game, but also critically important that we call people on that. I mean, there are ways to do that that are perhaps more civil in nature. And I don't use the term civility to say that we're going to just step back and let people do things. I use the term civility in ways that you can give respect to another person just by the dignity that every person deserves. But you can be very direct and in calling those things out and saying that we're not going to stand by the rhetoric that is going around and certainly not stand for any kind of hate speech.
Mm-hmm. How has the Des Moines community responded to knowledge of what happened?
It has been a terrific response, really. Lots of folks that have made statements either publicly or personally to folks in the Jewish community, because at the end of the day, this was an anti-Semitic flyer, and so it really does have more impact on them, obviously. But support to us, support to Planned Parenthood, and people who have made very clear statements that in Iowa and in our community, we will not tolerate hate, and we will always stand together against it.
What guidance would you offer other activists and organizers that find themselves targeted with hate speech or other kinds of attacks?
Well, I would always say be willing to speak out, find your voice in that, but also always work alongside other groups and other organizations. Most of our work is building relationships. Mm-hmm. And so when you have built those relationships ahead of time, when something like this happens, it's easy to make that call or send that email and say, this happened, and we need you to be alongside us. So most of that work is about the relationships that you have already built. Mm-hmm. but always, always being willing to use your voice.
Connie, how can our listeners support your work and stand with Interfaith Alliance of Iowa in defiance of this kind of attack?
Well, you can certainly follow us on social media. Facebook, we're pretty active on, so Interfaith Alliance Iowa. Website is interfaithallianceiowa.org. You can follow the work that we do there as well. And love to have the support of your good folks who listen to your program, and would love to have them engaged in our work.
Connie Ryan is Executive Director of Interfaith Alliance of Iowa in Des Moines. Their website is interfaithallianceiowa.org. Connie, I really thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio. It's great to talk with you again.
Thanks, Walton.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. We'll hear from a new film that argues that opposing the current administration is a defiance of God's will. It's called The Trump Prophecy. And up next, Whosoever You Love with Mitchell Gold. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Mitchell Gold could be leading a well-earned life of leisure and comfort, having built a successful designer furniture business and brand, Mitchell Gold and Bob Williams. But you know, that has never been Mitchell's path. Instead, he has fearlessly spoken out in defense of the dignity and value of LGBTQ persons, and he's done so for decades. And he has done so in what is all too often the most hostile of environments for those persons, organized religion, all while living in the buckle of the American Bible Belt. As we highlight stories of respect and dignity for LGBTQ persons of faith in our special series, Whosoever You Love, it is absolutely essential that we include Mitchell Gold, his story, and his vision. And so I am delighted to welcome my dear friend, Mitchell Gold, to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. It's so nice to be with you again today.
Mitchell, a lot of our listeners know your story already, but there are always those people who are hearing you for the first time. And so for them, I would ask you to just briefly introduce yourself and how you became an entrepreneur and an effective activist.
Well, I was born in 1951, so that makes me 67. It makes me a child of the 60s. Mm-hmm. And while there was a real expression of freedom, of newfound freedom in the 60s, for LGBT people, it was not necessarily so. And I grew up at a time when this American Psychiatric Association designated that, quote-unquote, homosexuality was a mental disorder. I grew up at a time when LGBT people really weren't out and feeling comfortable with themselves, but it was just starting. Mm-hmm. But for me, I was very closeted. I was very tormented. I thought that God hated me because in Sunday school, I read Leviticus. Mm-hmm. I thought that I was broken. And I spent too many nights crying myself to sleep. I spent too many nights trying to fix myself, pray that God would change me. And it wasn't until the early 70s when I went to a psychiatrist, and fortunately he asked, what was I there for? And I said, I need you to change me. And lucky for me, in 1971, he said, I can't change you. In fact, the American Psychiatric Association is getting ready to change their designation, and quote-unquote homosexuality will no longer be considered a mental disorder, but who you are. And I was so lucky to have that doctor. But it still socially created a problem for me because of my parents, my brother, my family, other family, my friends. So it was a while until I came out. But when I finally did, I like to say that I was born again, because then I really had the shackles of this mental anguish off of me. And I was living in New York City. I was around a lot of out successful people. I worked at Bloomingdale's. There were a lot of incredibly brilliant, creative, high-level people that happened to be gay. So that's really when I started to live my life and started to flourish as a human being. And fortunately for me, I had a good career path. I was successful. I found the right niche for me. I loved retailing. I loved being at Bloomingdale's. I left Bloomingdale's and worked for a variety of furniture companies. And then I started a business with Bob Williams, who we fell in love with each other and decided we wanted to own a business together. We started that, and in the 90s, moved down south, had a company, and that's when President Clinton proclaimed that he was going to allow gays to be in the military. Mm-hmm. And as you recall, there was a real backlash to it, and the backlash was largely from clergy who were screaming that LGBT people were immoral, they were sinners, and they shouldn't be serving next to you in the foxhole or in a submarine. And it really struck me that people were talking like this because as a child of the 60s, I remember all too well Governor Wallace saying things like segregation now, segregation forever. It says it in the Bible. Mm-hmm. And I remember asking my mother, did it say that in the Bible? And she said, not in our Bible. Mm-hmm. And I remember too well how people used their, I will call them outdated and misguided and ill-informed religious beliefs and harmful religious beliefs to marginalize other people, to put themselves in a superior position. Mm-hmm. And I was seeing it again in America and in my community. And living down south gave me a very different perspective than my friends who lived in New York or Washington or L.A. And I started talking then that I think the big problem with LGBT people not having full and equal rights was people using their religious beliefs. Other people might say it's the ick factor, or they might use some other excuses, but the roots of it are in these religious beliefs that being gay, LGBT, is a sin. So I started speaking out about it, and here I am today, still speaking out about it.
So I am so glad you are here today, like you are. How were you able to come to terms with your own identity, including in what you had been hearing about religion?
By my college years, I had really put religion aside, and I was a history student. So I saw too often how wars started, how religion was used in too many wars, how religion was used too often to marginalize people, and I really moved away from any kind of religion. You know, I don't know to this day if there is a God, how I was created. I just have a personal feeling that I want to be the best that I can. I do follow the dictum in the Jewish religion, Tikkun Olam, which means that you come into this world and you're here to make it a better place. And I do feel an obligation to every day try to make it a better place. And it also gives me a great amount of joy. And I think that is a good thing when mm-hmm. you can do good and feel good from it also. So I was away from organized religion, except that kind of living my life that way was an important thing to me. Mm-hmm. So I reconciled the religious part pretty quickly. And then I just had to reconcile the society part. And still in the 70s even, I didn't come out at work until the late 70s.
Mitchell, you became a very effective activist. You've launched several major initiatives to help free LGBTQ people of faith from both external and self-condemnation in the name of religion. I have known you a long time, and so I know how difficult it is for you to talk about yourself and especially about your accomplishments. But I think it is incredibly important for people to hear about the change that one man can cause to happen. So would you talk about those initiatives, if you would?
Well, as a business person, I found that if I have a problem in one of my stores, I go to that store and find out what's wrong. Is it the salespeople? Is it the display? Is it the assortment of furniture? Is it the advertising? What is it that's wrong? And you get down to the root cause. And I've come to the conclusion in the whole world of trying to find absolute equality for LGBT people, legally and spiritually, that the very teaching that some religions have, that homosexuality is a sin, and I always say that in quotes because it's not the way I would really say it, but it's the way often people who hold those religious beliefs feel or think. But that is the root. That is a really toxic teaching. And when you tell a 13 or 14-year-old kid that they're a sinner, that they're broken, that they're going against God's will, that causes enormous mental anguish for a kid. And I have found that a lot of people don't want to harm young, vulnerable, innocent kids. Mm-hmm. And when they understand that those words, those teachings can cause not just mental anguish, but cause an LGBT kid to be four times more likely to take their life, to contemplate taking their life, or to suffer mental anguish than a straight kid. When a kid comes from a highly rejecting home, and what's a highly rejecting home? It's usually a home that teaches that it's a sin, mm-hmm. and that not just teaches it, but really pushes it in the pulpit on a Sunday, that pushes it at home at the dinner table. You know, those kids that feel highly rejected, they're eight times more likely than the gay kid that's four times more likely. So it's really exponential. And I come across, I mean, right now as I sit here on the phone with you, I've got a couple of people that I've been in touch with, a young kid in Utah, a young kid in my community in Taylorsville, you know, that are really suffering a lot of mental anguish because of their parents' teachings. And I've come to the conclusion that we have to get everybody talking about the sin question, and we got to get it off the list. This cannot be taught anymore.
Right.
And I've seen a lot of change. I'm so optimistic, and I know that religions can change because in my own lifetime, I've seen religions change about their teaching about interracial marriage. I've seen teachings change about women's rights. Mm-hmm. You know, recently I was at a funeral in my hometown, in my town where my factory is, and a woman passed away. And the church where the funeral was a Southern Baptist church, one that I'm sure 50 years ago was against interracial marriage. But yet here was this woman's family. Two of her granddaughters married African Americans. Her grandchildren were interracial. And everybody was loving and accepting in that church. And her granddaughter spoke, and her great-granddaughter spoke, who was 14 or 15 years old. And I looked at this beautiful interracial child speaking on that pulpit in the Southern Baptist church and just know that 50 or 70 years ago, that would not have happened.
Yeah.
So people do change. And that's what I want to take it in a really positive note. There's so many clergy that you and I know, Tony Campolo, David mm-hmm. Gushee, you know, people who used to really be against LGBT people having marriage equality and used to believe that homosexuality is a sin. They no longer believe that because they've come to understand the human suffering involved in it. Mm-hmm. That's when church doctrine changes over the course of history, when human suffering has been exposed and can no longer be acceptable.
You work for change both globally and right in your hometown. I think sometimes the latter can be more difficult. What is it like to stand up for queer kids at school board meetings and other community events, Mitchell?
Well, it's interesting. I think I am naive about some of it, but I just do it because mm-hmm. I don't think I could go to sleep at night if I didn't do it. Mm-hmm. I don't think I could go to sleep at night if I allowed kids in our community to just be gobbled up by, I hesitate to use the word ignorance, but it really is ignorance when people don't understand or when people don't know something. And I don't think it's mean ignorance. I think it is loving ignorance. I think there's too many people in our community who harm their own children and their neighbors' children because they just don't know. And if I can stand up and speak in a calm, logical way, I can't change everybody, but I know, and it's part of the reason I'm optimistic, that there are so many members of our community who, in fact, have changed. One member of the administration in the county called me after a school board meeting, and he said, you know, I just want you to know that when you came here close to 30 years ago, when you first were open and talked about being gay and talked about equal rights, I thought you were crazy, and I didn't agree with you. But I've really come to understand that homosexuality is not a sin, and I have a young daughter, a teenager. I don't want her to think that. I don't want her to think that in case she's gay, and I don't want her to think that if she's not, because I don't want her to bully other kids who are, or think that she's better than other kids. And, you know, it's those kind of conversations that I have that really give me enormous hope for the future.
What do you think it's going to take, Mitchell, for LGBTQ persons to be fully included in the life of our nation? Are you more concerned, though, right now about a backlash moving things in the opposite direction?
No, I'm not really concerned about a backlash. I think what it's going to take is it's going to take every LGBT advocacy organization to not treat the hurdle of religious beliefs, of anti-LGBT religious beliefs, as a secondary part of their mission, to not have it to be some program that's over off to the side where the program director reports to somebody and reports to somebody else who finally reports to the president of the organization. Mm-hmm. It has to be front and center and in the DNA of every LGBT organization. It's about everybody out communicating and educating about this. People have to be educated about the harm that they're causing to other people. Mm-hmm. We can't stand up on a table and scream for rights. You'll never hear me say that my adversaries are haters. I mean, maybe Tony Perkins and some of the ringleaders and Franklin Graham, they're perverted haters. But for the most part, the everyday people, the people in the pews, they don't mean harm to other people. And if we don't share with them and explain to them the harm they are causing, they'll never know. Mm-hmm. So I think it's going to take every LGBT organization to talk about it. It's going to take other fair-minded organizations to talk about it. We've got to get this out on the table and talk about it and get people to understand. And if that happens, I don't think there's a backlash. Mm-hmm. In my own community, we have a gay-straight alliance at the high school. Was there a little backlash from some extreme clergy there? Yes. But they became the minority, and most people in the community saw that it was the fair thing to do to allow kids to gather for a club in high school and have camaraderie and to learn.
Mm. There are young people in this country who have come of age in reasonably safe surroundings. Maybe their parents were accepting pretty much right away. School friends are accepting. Popular culture is affirming for the most part. But for some of them, it might be that things seem to be going in the opposite direction. What would you say to one of those young people right now?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was interviewing somebody for a senior position, and they live in New York, and the first thing he said to me when he sat down was, you know, I just want to thank you for the work that you do, because I have a 13-year-old son who just came out, and he's, you know, getting himself through it. And I said, gosh, in New York City? Mm. And he said, yeah. He said, it's just not as easy as it sounds. And, you know, even there's just the peer pressure, mm-hmm, of not being the same. You know, 50% of the kids were gay. Make it easier. So I think it just takes them a little time. But for sure, parents' total acceptance and embracing, not just accepting and tolerating, but to really embrace their child and let them know that they totally love them exactly the way they are and support them. You know, that's what's so important for a young person. I mean, I had the good fortune of a father who totally embraced me when I came out to him. I'm not sure he would have done it when I was 14, but when I was 26 and came out, I'll always remember, he said to me, Mitchell, all I care about is that you're happy and healthy. I love you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for a parent to say that to a kid, it makes all the difference in the world. And when they don't hear that, it also makes all the difference in the world. Mm-hmm. That's not what my mother said to me, and that scarred me for a long time.
Yeah. Mitchell, where are you concentrating your efforts right now and in the months ahead, activism-wise?
Well, I'm really putting a lot of energy into the Tyler Clemente Foundation, because I think one way to talk to people is to get them to understand that true faith doesn't bully. And when a minister is on a pulpit and says that homosexuality is a sin, that's bullying a 13 or 14 or 15-year-old kid in their audience. When a clergy person tells an LGBT person that they need to pray their gay away or need to get a better relationship with God and that they're broken, that's bullying. And when parents tell their child that a child that comes out that and says they're gay, and they say, oh, I'm so sorry, you know, we can pray together, or let me get you a Christian counselor or something, that's bullying. Yeah. And there's all kinds of bullying that goes on. It's not just bullying in the schoolyard or bullying in the neighborhood. And the Tyler Clemente Foundation launched a program called True Faith Doesn't Bully. And Justin Lee is a fantastic fellow who's running the project. And I think we're going to hear a lot more from the Tyler Clemente Foundation about it. And a big effort is to get people to sign their Upstander Pledge. You can just Google Tyler Clemente Upstander Pledge and read it and sign it. And that will cause people to really think about when they see a minister standing in church and saying it's a sin and pummeling these people that are in the audience, whether they're 13 years old or 30 years old or 60 years old, to stand up to that minister and say, no, we can't talk like this anymore. We've got to talk about this. Or if a neighbor sees another neighbor who has a gay child and they're not treating that child well, to stand up for that child, to stand up for people. We can't just let other people hurt others.
Mm-hmm. Mitchell Gold is the co-founder and CEO of Mitchell Gold and Bob Williams, a global furniture and design brand based in North Carolina. Mitchell is a lifelong activist with a focus on young LGBTQ people and creating space for them to thrive both in secular and religious spaces in this country. In 2012, I was honored to present him with the Interfaith Alliance Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award, President's Award. Mitchell Gold, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Wilton. And I want you to know what's also exciting to me is when I'm in the factory after this airs, we have people who work for us in the factory that listen, and they're going to give me a thumbs up when they see me. Thank you so much for having me, and love to be with you and Judy always.
The Trump Prophecy is a film made by and for evangelical Christians, reinforcing the claim that the current president was anointed by God to enact his will, a will that variously includes suppression of Muslims, Jews, atheists, racial minorities, journalists, LGBTQ persons, and rebellious women, among others. An insightful analysis of the Trump Prophecy appeared recently at Vox.com, and I'm happy to be joined by religion writer and theologian Tara Isabella Barton. Tara, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for having me.
Who made the Trump Prophecy, or did it just drop down from heaven?
Well, it was made technically by a Charlotte area film production company called RealWorks. But what's particularly striking and newsworthy is the hand that Liberty University, the ultra-evangelical Lynchburg college founded by the late Jerry Falwell and currently presided over by his son, Jerry Falwell Jr., had a major hand in it. Members of Liberty University's cinema department were involved in making all aspects of the film. Now, this is not unprecedented. Making Christian films is something that is done by the university, but usually they tend to be more of the feel-good faith variety rather than anything overtly political. I should clarify that the university has put out a statement saying that participation was technically voluntary, that students could choose to do another senior project, but students have reported a kind of institutional pressure to the extent that this was very much a university project that one was to be affiliated with. And certainly Jerry Falwell Jr. has been a longstanding supporter of Trump. That dynamic and some students' reticence has caused tension on campus in the past.
As I recall, Falwell had from the very beginning endorsed the president as God's choice. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. While other evangelical leaders, one might say, have come around to Trump, Falwell Jr. in particular has been a longstanding supporter, not just of Trump the person, but of a very particular brand of Christian nationalism that he sees Trump as representing. And certainly the Liberties campus, I believe they recently announced that they were building a drone center, that there's been a kind of great deal of support for firearms. At the policy level, Liberty is very excited about Trump's policies.
As I understand it, this was distributed pretty widely.
So I believe the number provided by Liberty was 1,200 theaters. However, the film only premiered, there's a 7 p.m. showing on Tuesday, October 2nd, and Thursday the 4th. I will say at the screening I attended, which was in New York City, there were only about 10 people there. New York near the NYU campus is perhaps not the epicenter of Trumpist evangelical culture, but it's hard to get a sense of how many people actually saw it. But the sheer number of cinemas suggests that there is a very concerted effort to spread the show as widely as possible. And certainly Fathom Events, the company to which I bought the tickets, was very much encouraging like prayer groups to come together and this to be a prayerful event. Just as an example, the event I went to, the screening I went to, almost everyone there seemed to know one another and be part of a prayer group. And immediately after the film, began to recite the Bible and sing in praise of God and particularly his decision to put Trump in the White House. So very much for those that did attend, it was framed not only as you should see this movie because it's important to see it because it's true, but also you should see this movie as an act of prayer and worship. This is something you should do with your church or your fellow Christians.
Tara, try to describe the vision for America that's presented in this film.
Fundamentally, the vision of America and the world in the film is of one where God acts in history to protect certain countries with whom God has a covenant. In the film, that is just two countries, that is America and it is Israel. The idea of the film, which is very much coded, not very much of this is stated outright, but plot, the subtext of everything from the way the characters interact with each other to a series of interviews with prominent evangelicals and others featured after the film, is this. God acts in history to choose the president. Once that person is in office, their legitimacy comes not merely from having been elected, but from being God's chosen one. Mm-hmm. So with reference to Trump, and I will say the film never explores the idea whether if Hillary had won, her authority would likewise have been from God. This is conveniently left off the table. Yeah. But it does not matter in the film what Trump's policies are. In fact, it's a few times in the film where evangelicals kind of wink and nod and say, well, Trump, you know, he's not exactly a family man or he needs all the prayer he could get. So there's a subtext in the film that Trump is not in character the expected evangelical candidate. But that doesn't matter because there's no sense in the world of the film that his policies, that his fitness for office, that anything about him as a person makes him fit to rule. Only God's choice makes him fit to rule. Now you might say, oh, well, that's not so bad. At least they're not trying to make us believe he's a great leader. But I would motion that it's actually much more frightening because I don't think that the film is trying to convince people to vote for Trump because he is good. I think the film is trying to solidify in the minds of its audience the idea that any resistance to authority, any resistance to God's chosen one, any doubt on a policy level, on a personal level, that this person is in power because God wants him to, is tantamount to a turning away from God. So it's a subtle distinction, I think, but an important one, and ultimately a more long-lasting one. Because the message of the Trump prophecy, the idea that just by praying for our guy to win because our guy is the guy God wants, and once he's in office, we've got to trust him because God has a plan, is one that strikes at the heart of the Democratic project. The very legitimacy of the political process is called into question.
I know the president and his supporters are heroes in this and similar narratives. But Tara, who are the quote-unquote enemies, and how does this story end for them?
The film is not explicit about this. I will say that the film does not ever outright say atheists or LGBTQ people or unruly women are enemies. The film is much more subtle than that, if you can call a film like that subtle. What the film wants us to think is that anyone who turns away or resists God's will, God's power, and God's authority is de facto an enemy. A frequent Bible verse that is quoted in the film is 2 Chronicles 7:14, where it's the idea that a people have turned away from God, but a remnant who turned back to God will help him heal a troubled land. And, of course, we can see echoes of Make America Great Again in that. Mm-hmm. But the thrust of the argument is that, you know, we are in a secular society. We're in a godless society. We're in a world that's turned its back on God. And only the few, the proud, the well-meaning evangelicals who turn back to God can save us from that. Now, implicitly, those enemies are, of course, Democrats and feminists and atheists. This is very much coded in the film. The only unsympathetic character we ever see in the film is a woman, aristocratic woman, who is sort of a parody of a liberal who sits drinking martinis, looking miserable, while our heroes delay a flight because they're too busy praying. Mm-hmm. These people are cast as enemies. The liberals, the ones who hate God, the ones who don't believe America is a Christian nation. And here I just want to point out that the film is heavily indebted to the historical work of a man called David Barton, who is a discredited historian whose books have actually been recalled because of the number of factual errors, but whose books are all about how America was founded as an explicitly Christian nation that it is supposed to be, if not a theocracy, then at least a Christian nation first and a pluralist nation second. And David Barton appears in the film as a talking head. His books are advertised before the film. But this narrative that America is supposed to be a Christian nation, that several major evangelical figures as well as politicians espouse, I know Sam Brownback in particular is someone who's been close with Barton. This narrative basically casts anyone who resists the narrative of America as a Christian nation as largely ahistoric as it is, as being both against God and against America. They're not real patriots. And these are the people who are leading America in a diabolical direction, that are plunging America into sin. And the Making America Great Again that Trump promises is thus doubled as a theological promise of purifying America in God's eyes, leading up to an apocalyptic future, although different evangelicals conceive of that future differently.
Of course, these beliefs are right at the core beliefs of the political religious right today. I wonder, where do you see the line between these kinds of beliefs and this message and just an outright cult?
So I tend to resist language about cults in general. I think that there's that old joke about pornography, you know it when you see it. And I think the same thing is true of any kind of cult or language about cults, that there really isn't a solid set of principles that we can apply. What I will say is this. Christian nationalism is nothing new. John Fee, F-E-A, at Messiah College has written a wonderful book about this called Believe Me, The Evangelical Road to Donald Trump. But the idea that Christian identity and American patriotism are linked has been one that has ebbed and flowed throughout American culture. So that's nothing new. Likewise, ideas about the end of times, or, you know, a second coming followed by a period of tribulation, or vice versa. Generally, rapture ideology is not at all uncommon, but is distinct to American or Anglo-American evangelicalism. So I'm actually very reticent to say these group of people over here believe this thing that I, as a mainline Episcopalian, find strange, and thus they're a cult. Rather, the way that I would look at it is that several tendencies already extant in the American right, in the evangelical right, in evangelical Christian culture, and in kind of perhaps secular world of Southern white supremacy, are all combining at this place and time, so that we see in this an intensification of existing trends, not something new.
Tara, you're a theologian who writes about religion for Vox.com. That is really exciting because far too few publications recognize how influential religious themes are on many or even most stories. Would you just briefly talk about your work and how this role came about?
Absolutely. I'm the first full-time religion reporter Vox has had, although they've had fellows cover it at various points. And I actually started out as an academic theologian and a travel writer, and my theology was my work. I did my doctorate at Oxford. But I realized as I was doing a lot of academic work for a smaller audience that I really wanted to change tack a bit and be in a position where I could translate so much of what's going on to an audience that, as you say, is often unaware of it. I think religion has often been treated too simply by the secular media. You're religious or you're not. You're Christian or you're not. At most, there'll be a vague distinction between like a Catholic, a mainline Protestant, evangelical. And even then, there might not be a kind of realization about the sort of racial demographics of this or the degrees into which white evangelicals are their own political bloc. And there's all this information out there that, in my view, is central to understanding so much of our political discourse that is often reduced to a binary of religious, conservative, liberal, atheist, and not much in between. And that's actually not true. One of the most interesting statistics I've come across lately, which is from a PRRI poll, indicated that pretty much every demographic in America, religious demographic in America, has remained consistent on Trump since the inauguration. So the religiously unaffiliated have always opposed, white evangelicals have long supported. But there's a big shift, or a 9-point shift, which is pretty significant, among mainline Protestants, so your Episcopalians and your Methodists and what have you, where they're increasingly moving away from him. And I think that stories like that and a realization that religion is a multifaceted and various force, and that it's not a yes or no binary where religious people feel one way and non-religious people feel a different way, even within, say, Christianity, is something that people don't understand well enough. And I'm so grateful that Vox decided to invest in exploring that question and that I'm the one who gets to do that.
Dr. Tara Isabella Burton is a theologian and a religion writer at Vox.com. Her insightful analysis of the Trump prophecy appeared at Vox, and we'll link to it from stateofbelief.com. Tara, it's great to meet you, and I know you've got a book coming out next year, and I hope that you will come and talk with us when that comes out, because we'll be interested in it. But thank you today for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a wonderful rest of your day.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. I hope you'll take some time to reflect on what you've heard today and how it relates to the priorities of your citizenship. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you think there's value in the conversations we present and the voices we amplify in the midst of the gridlock our public rhetoric too often becomes, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.